to be standing here in celebration and in introduction of Ilan Hafez, who is coming to us now from Exeter, University of Exeter in the UK. Ilan Hafez has been very well known for a number of things. Some of them are because of conflicts, but some of them are because of his accomplishments. And I think in way of introduction, I'd like to emphasize the fact that he is, he established himself on three levels. One is that he is an accomplished historian who has been very rigorous in his retelling of the history of the area, of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and Palestinian life. But also he's been a great public intellectual throughout. And then he was a political activist and a strong one. In terms of him as an accomplished historian, he was marked as one of the new historians in Israel who in the 1980s retold the story of the emergence of the nation state of Israel and retold it from a different point of view, especially given the advantage of the opening of the archives in Britain and in Israel from the 1940s and 50s. And with hindsight, they were able to tell a new story about the emergence of Israel and a new story about the Palestinian experience. And they focused on the expulsion of Palestinians from Palestine rather than retelling it from the official Israeli history story, which is narrative, which depends on telling the story as Palestinians have, left of their own will. So the new historians established themselves as really rigorous historians who told a new narrative, a narrative that gave voice to the Palestinian population especially. But the new historians themselves diverged along the way, and some new historians took that story of atrocities against the Palestinians that they told about to say, wait a minute, maybe we should have finished the job and got all the Palestinians out from Palestine. There is a new historian who said that recently in The Guardian, and that was a shocker for every one of us. Ilan Hafez, on the other hand, was on the other side of the story. He went even more into appreciating his role as someone who respects human rights, the dignity of life, the Palestinian experience, and because of that he emphasized rather very well that that you cannot actually establish the narrative of Israeli story, Israeli history, official history, as the true history, and you have to tell the story from a Palestinian side. But also as a public intellectual, it's important to emphasize the fact that he emphasized this continuity of appreciating human rights and the dignity of life. But as a political activist, he ran actually for the Knesset in 1999 on the list of Hadash. He also called for a number of things. For example, he called for academic boycott of Israeli academic institutions, and that got him in real trouble within his institutions in Israel at the University of Haifa, but also otherwise. He also called for political and economic boycott of Israeli occupation, especially institutions that benefit from occupation. So all around, he's been a very exemplary, not only academic, but also world citizen, I would say. But in addition to that, he is he produces as much as probably a number of us here. Probably all of us can maybe count five books to our names. He can count five books to his name in 2011. So I will just mention those and leave everything else aside from the last 40 years, 30 years. So he has Out of Frame from 2011. And of course, I'm talking about books like one of them, for example, from Yale University Press. One of them is from, all of them are, many of them are from university presses that are established. Another one is with Noam Chomsky on the war in Gaza. Another one is on the Husseinis, which is a clan, a Palestinian family name. And he talks about here the rise and fall of a Palestinian aristocracy. He also published Across the Wall, another book that he published with another person. And then he published also The Forgotten Palestinians. So without further introduction, please you know, welcome Ilan with me.
Thank you, Summer, for very kind words. I wish my wife would be in here. She would have heard it for the first time, some good things. I wish my late mother would be here. She would have even believed you. Well, I'm very happy to be here. In the two talks today and tomorrow, I hope to cover a topic which actually I try and cover in a whole course or module in the university in a term. So I try and squeeze into two long lectures a topic which deserves a much more expanded series of lectures. I think we can compensate for the lack of time to discuss everything by knowing that many of you probably have the background and know much of what I'm going to talk about anyway. And for those who are relatively new to the topic, at least I hope this will be an appetizer to read more and to engage in the conversation on Palestine here in the United States, which is a very important one, not just for the sake of Palestinians and Israelis, but I think also for the sake of America's global standing and future relationship with the Middle East and the Muslim world. The Zionist movement emerged in the late 19th century out of two impulses. And I would say that these were in many ways noble impulses. The first impulse was to find a safe haven for communities in Central and Eastern Europe that felt in the late 19th century more than ever before as being under threat of annihilation. And communities who had suffered years of persecution and discrimination. And there was a sense among community leaders and activists in the Jewish community in the late 19th century that worse is to come. And of course, they were vindicated in the next century when European Jewry suffered a genocide during the Holocaust. So the first, I think, impulse, the most basic reason for creating the Zionist movement was to find a safe place for endangered Jewish communities. The second impulse was to redefine Judaism as a national movement. This was not unique to the Jewish communities in Europe. Ever since the Spring of Nations in 1848, quite a few religious, cultural, and ethnic communities in Europe felt that they would be better defined and would better cater for their own needs if they would adopt this new idea of nationalism. So Judaism, in the eyes of Zionist activists, was not just a religion, but also a national movement. The idea was, from very early on, that if you want to save the Jewish communities in Europe, and you want to redefine Judaism as a national movement, you cannot do it on European soil. You have to look for a different continent, a different place. Now, this is the age of colonialism we are talking about. Oh, I didn't turn off. Do you need my mic?
Yes.
You do? Okay. Is that better? I don't hear any difference. There's a green light on my trousers. Maybe that indicates something else. I don't know. Can you hear me now? Did I do something wrong?
Could you move the microphone up just a little bit?
Can you take it up?
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're hearing something different now. Oops. I'll warm up anyway. So the idea was that geographically you cannot satisfy these two impulses in Europe. And this being the age of colonialism, and the movement being the European movement, it's not surprising that the rest of the world seemed open. As some of you may know, that the first choice was actually a place in the United States, not far away from the Niagara Falls, which the leaders of the Zionist movement thought would be the new found Jerusalem, so to speak. Then there were talks about Azerbaijan, Argentina. The most famous option was Uganda in Africa, and of course Palestine as well, due to the centrality of Palestine in Judaism. But it was not in many ways the first choice, and the leader of the Zionist movement, Theodor Herzl, preferred Uganda actually to Palestine. The reason that eventually Palestine was chosen had to do with Christian Zionism, or Zionist Christians, Christian Zionism, as it was called then, which appeared in the very early 19th century on both sides of the Atlantic. Evangelical churches regarded the idea of the return of the Jews to Palestine as, of course, a precursor of the divine scheme for the resurrection and the second coming of the Messiah. And return of the Jews was an important element in it, and definitely there was a pressure on the Zionist movement to choose Palestine for Christian reasons. Needless to say that sometimes happened with some churches, the motive was also anti-Semitic. If you can both precipitate the second coming of the Messiah and get rid of the Jews in Europe in the same ticket, that's quite a good idea. And of course you don't tell the Jews on the trip, don't read the small letters. Small letters said that when the Messiah is coming back, you guys have to convert to Christianity or you will be shish kebab in hell. And that part of the scheme is still there with Christian Zionists, as you know, today. But they are the best allies of Israel, because either Israelis like to be barbecued in hell, or they don't read the small letters. I would go for the second option when it comes to Israelis. In any case, whatever the historical reasons are, Palestine was chosen as the venue in which one could satisfy these two noble impulses, safety and national independence, if you want. As you all probably know, the problem is that Palestine was not empty. And from very early on, and this is very well documented for one particular reason, early Zionist settlers were quite obsessive diarists and writers. Every thought they had, every mosquito bite they suffered from, you can read about, probably more than you would like to. And there's nothing that escaped their pen. And there are mountains of documents one can read if you want to reconstruct both the leader's perception of what to do with the indigenous native population of Palestine and the more sort of average member of the movement. And do remember, when we're talking about the early Zionist movement, let's say from 1880 to 1930s, it's a very small number. It's 150,000, maybe 200,000, and therefore it's quite a manageable community for a researcher to have a good idea of what people felt. What they felt is still with us today. And the basic idea was that people believed or wanted to believe that A, once they chose Palestine, they chose an ancient homeland. So the basic concept was of returning to a homeland. Now, what do you do when you return to a homeland and someone else is in your home? The fact that you actually left home 2,000 years ago is forgotten in this kind of engagement. And what matters is that someone has illegally occupied your home. And that comes very strongly in the early Zionist writing and also in the a way that Zionist leaders and Zionist discourse develops in the 1920s and the 1930s. There is kind of a paradox typical to colonialist movements, by the way. The Palestinians sometimes are not there because it's very convenient to treat Palestine as terra nulla, an empty land, as did the settlers who came to Australia, treated the Aboriginals' presence there. But sometimes they are there, and then you have to demonize them in order to disregard their connection to the place. So they are either absent or they are usurpers, called the illegal occupants of your homeland. The Zionist movement in the 1920s and the 1930s, to be fair, was not very occupied with the question of what would be the fate of the Palestinians in Palestine. They were busy with other worries. Would the international community protect them? Would there be enough Jews? This is before the Holocaust. Would there be enough Jews who would come to Palestine? Can they create an independent state under the British mandate and so on? In a very bizarre and a very, of course, painful way, one could say that the Holocaust and even the rise in Nazism and fascism before the Holocaust in the 1930s calmed down some of the Zionist fears. Jews were coming to Europe, from Europe, because it was impossible to stay in Europe as a Jew. The community in Palestine reached quite a sizable number, and it seemed that the British mandatory authorities allowed the Zionist community to build a state within a state, or build an infrastructure for a future state. And this is when, in 1936, 1937, Zionist leaders begin to attract attention or divert their attention to the question of what would be the fate of the Palestinians in Palestine. And something very clear comes out from there up to the end of the British mandate. For the Jewish community in Palestine to not only to survive, but also to thrive, to excel, to succeed, and for the Jewish community to become democratic, to be part of a democratic world, for that to happen, it has to have an absolute majority in the land. It also has to have a control over much of the land. So there is a geographical dimension and there is a demographic dimension. It comes very clear out in the late 1930s. Jews have to have supremacy, if possible exclusivity, and Jews have to have physical control over the ancient land of Palestine. The problem is, of course, that even in 1938, the Jews are still only one-third of the population, and they don't have control even over one square inch of Palestine. So they're waiting for the right historical moment. And that historical moment comes in 1948, when the British government decides that it had enough of fighting both Jews and Arabs, and in any case, the British Empire collapses after the Second World War. The day the British mandatory authorities inform both Jews and Arabs that the British mandate is coming to an end is the day that the Zionist political and military leadership decided on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. That's the moment when everything comes into place for the leadership of the Zionists. They have a chance to create a Jewish state. They have a chance to create a democratic Jewish state to be part of the Western world. And they have a chance to get rid of the Arabs, of the Palestinians, because it's very near to the Holocaust. There is an inbuilt immunity for anything Jews would do 2 years or 3 years after the Holocaust. And in many ways, they exploited the decision of Arab neighboring states to go to war against the future Jewish state. So you can use the situation of the war to implement an ethnic cleansing program. I would say that the final details of that program are articulated in March 1948 in by now the famous or infamous plan D of the Jewish military forces, the Haganah, in Palestine. Now, ethnic cleansing is a very loaded term, and one should be careful when one uses such terms. But in my book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, I decided to use a source which I don't always regard as the beacon of truth, but I knew that all my Israeli Jewish friends and their friends around the world would treat it as a beacon of truth. And this is the website of the State Department. The website of the State Department has a very clear definition of ethnic cleansing. And I try to show in my book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, how that definition fits what happened in Palestine in 1947-48. It's very interesting that according to the State Department, you don't even need to have a clear-cut master plan for expulsion. You don't need to expel the whole population. And you do not need to make sure that not everyone is allowed to return to be regarded as an ethnic cleanser. So even in the soft version, what the Zionist movement did to the Palestinians was ethnic cleansing. I think it's even harsher than that. All in all, as you probably know, the Israeli army within 7 months expelled half of Palestine's population. And if you want to understand the magnitude of the crime, you actually have to look at the map of Israel. Israel was built over 80% of Palestine. In the 80% of Palestine that became the Jewish state, 80% of the population were expelled. Half of Palestine villages were destroyed. When I say they were destroyed, they were wiped out. And instead of their place, the new Jewish state created either Jewish settlements or planted recreational forests. The urban space of Palestine changed beyond recognition. Whole cities just disappeared. In Haifa, the Palestinian population, out of the Palestinian population of 70,000 people, out of that population, only a few thousands were left. And there are similar proportions in Jaffa. And there are towns that were just demolished and disappeared altogether. Now, it's very interesting that the Israeli narrative was that this was done voluntarily. Palestinians must be very special people. I mean, so they obliterate the cities voluntarily. They leave their homes voluntarily. It's like a big picnic. Let's go out and put some TNT in our house and leave it. Great fun. Never to come back to where we lived for 700 years. I don't think there's any other historical crime that was committed that has such a counter-narrative. There are counter-narratives to criminal acts. People justify it. They find extenuating circumstances. The Israeli invention is that the Palestinian did it voluntarily. I've never heard such a thing about any other case study. I must tell you, visiting the States again and again, it's the last place it's being believed is here. Israelis don't believe it anymore. But Americans do. But well, you are gullible people in many ways. You know that. It's quite easy to sell you fables such as these without much effort. But it's really time to wake up. People do not voluntarily destroy their villages and cities and leave their home country. And people who are not allowed to come back, whatever the reason is, are being expelled. This is another of the sort of fabrication of history, that since some of the Palestinians did leave because they were afraid, they were not allowed to go back, but the Israelis count them as people who voluntarily left. If the city of Madison would be under the danger of being under nuclear attack from Canada, and you would all leave, you would not voluntarily leave. You leave because you think that nuclear bombs are not a place, are not a situation you might encounter. And if you would not be allowed to return after the threat is over, if the mayor of Madison would not, at least some of you would like to see them back, he would expel you. And according to the international law, he would commit a crime. The amazing thing about the 1948 ethnic cleansing is that on the ground you had reporters, including from the New York Times. On the ground you had the emissaries of the International Red Cross. You had people working for the United Nations. People saw with their own eyes. In fact, if you read American reports, people talk about expulsion all the time in their reports from the ground itself. In 1948, there was no need for the new historians to wait for the big declassification of new archives to know that. But the editors-in-chief in New York, the head of the Red Cross, the Secretariat of the United Nations, decide for understandable reasons that 2.5 years or 3 years after the Holocaust, you don't blame the Jews of committing crimes. There are more even cynical interests behind hiding this crime. And the reason is Germany. Already in 1948-49, it was very important for the West to reintroduce Germany to the community of civilized nations. It was very important, I mean Western Germany, because the Cold War was raging. It was very important. Germany was the front line. And a deal was created. The only people who could say that Germany is a new Germany were the Israelis, because they were the representative in the eyes of the world of the Jewish victims of the Holocaust. They were the ones. And they were willing to absolve Germany, to allow it to come back to the community or family of nations. The price was that the world decided to be silent on what happened in Palestine. There were other more objective reasons, or more easy reasons to understand. After the Second World War, so many people were moved around and expelled, and the magnitude of the tragedies that the world has seen in 1939 to 1945, one can see why the expulsion of 750,000 people was not seen as something that extraordinary or something that demands a particular attention. It was a very bad year for to be a victim of an ethnic cleansing. It's much better to be today. But the fact that the world sent a very clear message to Israel, you are still a democracy, you are a dignified member of the community of civilized nations, despite the fact that you have ethnically cleansed the Palestinians, was a very important message. Because the idea of ethnic purity and supremacy became the ideological infrastructure for the Jewish state. Therefore, the Palestinians who remained in Israel were put under military, ruthless military regime between 1948 to 1966, and the world didn't care because Israel was still the only democracy in the Middle East. It was America's main ally in the Cold War, and it was regarded as a domestic affair. Now, here we come to 1967. The 1967 war has its own mythology. And it's time to write the new history of 1967 as well. I mean, we have lived for too long with the narrative of 67 as we still teach it and read about it as just an Arab attempt to wipe out Israel, and a miraculous Israeli response that defeated the Arab armies in 6 days, and so on. It's far more complex than that, but I won't go into the details of that. But of course, I would be very happy to answer questions or respond to comments on that as well. What I'm interested in here is less why Israel went to war in 67, but as I tell you, I think that one has to revisit that period as well and not just take for granted what we are being told. But far more important, whatever the reasons are, it's very important to revisit what happened immediately after the war. Because after the war, the Israelis had control over 100% of Palestine. They controlled 80% of Palestine in 1948, but the remaining 20% became under Israeli control in 1967. With the 20%, which was a great geographical achievement, came, from an Israeli point of view, a new demographic headache, because the territory came with 1.5 million Palestinians, half of them refugees who were expelled by Israel in 1948, exactly as not to count them in the demographic balance of the Jewish state. So when you are hungry for territory in the 1960s, it's very different from when you are hungry for territory in the colonialist age. In the colonialist age, if you are hungry for territory and you don't like the people, you can either genocide them or expel them. It wasn't that easy in the 1960s, although some Israelis contemplated that as well. But the war, in many ways, was too short, 6 days war. And the Israelis were left with the kind of territory they always wanted. They really felt like, geographically, this is the future Jewish state. But demographically, this was really a problem. 1.5 million, an additional 1.5 million Palestinians to what was then already a sizable Palestinian minority inside Israel. Not only that, these were 1.5 million Palestinians who did not live for 19 years under Israeli rule. There were more Palestinians, if you want, than Israeli Palestinians. They were far more connected to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, to Palestinian identity and nationalism. Therefore, they were not just demographic point of view a problem, but also from an ideological point of view. They constituted quite a threat in the eyes of the Israelis. Now, the Israeli government has set day after day after the 6 days war, and to the credit of the Israelis, and this is still a mystery, the Israelis are, although they're getting worse in it, but they're basically not too bad in opening up documentation. And in 1997, in 1998, the Israeli archives for these meetings of June and July 1967, all through to the summer of 1968, were made open to the public. And you learn a lot from these meetings. You learn that basically, the Israeli cabinet and leadership saw the 67 war as a continuation of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. Regardless of how they thought the war happened, whether they blamed themselves or Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, or it didn't matter. Some of them thought that the Egyptians are responsible for the war, but that landed Israel with a golden opportunity. Others were more aware of the Israeli action that led to the war, but in the end of the day, it's the same thing. There was an historical opportunity to take over the rest of Palestine. And then you can see throughout the daily meetings that they had that they take three major decisions, which are with us today. They haven't changed. It's quite amazing. It's the same reality. Oh, I would say all the successive governments of Israel, including this current government, are loyal to these three decisions. One decision was the territories will have to remain part of Israel. Whatever happens, whatever you promise, whatever peace process you will be engaged in, basically these territories, especially the West Bank, not so much the Gaza Strip, but especially the West Bank, is the ancient heart of the Israeli nation, and therefore they have to remain in Israeli hands. Secondly, Israel cannot expel the Palestinians from these territories. Maybe it was possible in 1948, the world would not tolerate it in 1967. So whoever brought to the government, some ministers brought to the government, ideas of getting rid of the Palestinians, the vast majority of the ministers rejected the idea. Thirdly, there is no way that the Palestinians would remain, therefore, because they will not be expelled, in the territories that should remain under Israeli control, there's no way that these Palestinians would be granted equal citizenship. And there are interesting linguistic debates in the cabinet what to call them. And they come up with the Hebrew word toshavim, inhabitants. They are the inhabitants of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which means they are citizenless citizens. They are inhabitants, as if the Gaza Strip is Madison, a city, or the West Bank is Chicago. It's an inhabitants of a city. There are also sort of decisions that emanate from these three major decisions. For instance, there's a wish to be involved in the peace process and to be guided by the Americans in the peace process. But it's very clear from the very beginning that the peace process cannot in any way question the validity of the three decisions taken. Namely, the peace process has to provide means by which Israel can continue to control the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, directly or indirectly, means by which Israel would be allowed to retain the Palestinians without full citizenship, and means by which Israel would not be forced to expel the Palestinians because it would be forced by the international community to grant them equal rights, such as the right to vote, for instance, about their own future. And I would like to end so that to give you enough time for a long discussion, I hope, by saying that the Israelis detailed to death the reality, if I may use this sentence. And it's very important to understand it. One, and I would describe it best because I want to claim that this is ethnic cleansing in different means. It's not dramatic as the 1948 ethnic cleansing, but it is ethnic cleansing in different means. And they take additional decisions, and through these additional decisions, I would hopefully conclude the picture and leave it there, and then we can open up a discussion. One decision is whether to involve or not to involve the Israeli Supreme Court in the running of the occupation. According to international law, those of you who know the international law, Israel was not obliged to involve the local Supreme Court in running the affairs of the occupation. That's what the international law says. And yet the Israelis said, no, we want our Supreme Court, which is the most respected establishment in the state of Israel, the most respected establishment outside of Israel, to keep an eye on our forces and our troops, so that to show that they are exceptionally moral in their behavior. The result was, of course, the opposite. And since the result was the opposite, I have a nagging feeling that the motivation was exactly the opposite. It was not to keep an eye on the Israeli crimes, it was to legitimize them. Almost every decision that people were taking to the Supreme Court against confiscation of land, demolition of houses, expulsion of people, imprisonment of people without a trial, all the inventory of Israeli criminal acts that we are familiar with after 40 years of occupation, were legalized by the Supreme Court of Israel, which meant that when people like you would come out and say, wait a minute, we are part of, I don't know, Human Watch, United Nations, international agencies, churches in Seattle, I don't know, we come from all over the world and we have a high standard and we don't like what you do, the Israelis would say to you, sorry, we have the internet, we have the Supreme Court. We checked it with our Supreme Court, it's fine. That's why international law in Israel is, in the eyes of Israelis, tantamount to anti-Semitism. If you say international law, they think about anti-Semitism. What do you need international law when you have the Supreme Court of Israel making decisions? So that's one part of the occupation that has to be understood. Now it doesn't matter anymore because the Israelis are going to change the whole composition of the Israeli Supreme Court, and all the liberal Zionist judges are going to be replaced anyway by national religious and extreme nationalist judges, so at least the world will not have to believe these things. The second issue, which is very interesting, is the issue of the land regime. This is a fascinating story. Those of you who come from the West Bank, you know it. The Israelis, of course, could go around, confiscate land, give it to settlers, and go home, right? No, they wanted it to be legal. So they looked at the international law. The international law does not allow them either to allow any Jew to colonize. It's against the international law. You cannot bring your own citizens to an occupied land. Nor are you allowed to confiscate private land. And the Israelis said, okay, we have to abide by these issues, but we can be clever. A, we will find a way of showing that the land is not private, and then we can give it to the settlers. So there's an interesting chapter in the legal history of the occupation where the Israelis are recruiting the academic institutes and experts, which is one of many good reasons to boycott Israeli academia later on. They recruit them and they say to them, can you come up with something that would allow us not just to use force, but to show that this is legal? So they come up with the idea that during the time of the Ottoman Empire, private land, it's called Mawat in Arabic, private land that was not cultivated for 3 years was returned to the empire, became a state land, right? Now there was a problem. Most Palestinians never left a land uncultivated for 3 years, and the Ottoman Empire was long gone, right? But count on the Israelis, they resuscitated the Ottoman Empire, and they had a scale of time which fitted the Middle East better than the rest of the world. Namely, if you didn't cultivate the land for 3 months, it's nearly 3 years. Here and there, 3 months, 4 months is nearly 3 years. The man who was the inventor of this was Ariel Sharon. And there's a famous trip he takes with a helicopter, and he says, this is Mawat, this is Mawat, this is Mawat. And that's how they legalized settlements and declared it a state land. Now, why do they need it? That's why dictators need elections. They need to feel that this is legalized. But it all goes back to 48. You use force to dispossess the Palestinians, but you use legal discourse in order to say that this is not an ordinary case of ethnic cleansing. This is legal, it was examined, it can be recognized. And I will end with another Israeli decision that I'm not sure you know about, which also completes the picture. When Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967-1968, the first Palestinian guerrilla operations against the occupation started. People would come from the West Bank, from Jordan, and infiltrate into the West Bank. And the first group was caught. It's a typical Palestinian story, but we leave the Palestinian alone tonight. How they were caught was quite pathetic, but never mind. They were caught. And they had a military fatigue, and their intention was to attack a military installation. According to the international law again, this is a military operation. This is not terrorism. The Israelis had a very serious discussion, which I just discovered the other day, whether to call these guys terrorists or not. In fact, they consulted American experts, French experts, all over the world, who told them, yes, this is a liberation movement that sent a military unit, and therefore the people you caught should be treated as prisoners of war, and you should ask the Red Cross to come receive them. And the Israelis decided, no, they are terrorists. And the terrorizing the Palestinian action against the occupation became a very important part from legalizing anything the Israelis will do later on, whether it's collective punishment of demolishing houses, expelling people, putting almost every third person in the West Bank in prison without trial through their lives, putting children in prison. Everything is legalized because whatever you do as a Palestinian in the West Bank is part of a terrorist action. and it's all grounded in legalism. So when you face the ethnic cleansing of Palestine between 48 and 67, you are facing a state that genuinely believes it found a legal way of justifying what it does. So it won't be enough to protest and say what you're doing is wrong. You need to study. You need to analyze. You need to deconstruct their actions, because the shield that defends them is not just sheer power, military power, financial aid from the United States. It is also a complex structure, a narrative that they have built, which a lot of good people around the world still believe, and making them disbelieve that this is not an easy project, believe me, I know it at first. But I hope this lecture contributes something to this very sacred mission. Thank you very much.